Okie dokie. The training world is full of technical editing courses that don't teach the high-end creativity that viewers expect. Inside the Edit was created specifically to teach you every single creative skill you'll ever need to mesmerize your audience. Hey, welcome back to another episode of Once Upon a Timeline, the Creative Editing Podcast. As always, this is your host, Paddy Bird, and I want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy filmmaking lives to join me for our weekly discussion around the art of editing. So, what's on the menu for this week's creative feast? Well, we're going to gorge ourselves with as much tantalizing discussion as time allows on the delicious topic of visual grammar. The actual rules and regulations of how we place shots down on the timeline and structure sequences for our audience. There's much to be discussed in this fascinating subject, dear friends, and a ton of valuable techniques that you can use straight away. Our whole purpose on Once Upon a Timeline is to turn you into a powerful creative editor. If you want to go deeper into learning the art of editing, stay tuned as we've got a bunch of things going on right now at Inside the Edit that are very, very cool. From our latest live bootcamp webinar next week to a free two-week taster course over the Easter holidays for our master's degree later in the year. I'll tell you about some of them later on in the show. Okay, get comfortable. It's time to tuck into this week's creative discussion, an editor's guide to visual grammar. Human conduct, storytelling, narrative construction, and many of the essential concepts in filmmaking can't be measured like physics in a laboratory. They fall into the nebulous arenas of perception, emotion, and psychology, which even our greatest scientists and thinkers throughout the ages have struggled to measure and delineate. For us as editors, there is no precise formula to follow, as every single set of raw footage is completely unique. Every single one of them throws up individual sets of issues, errors, good points, bad points, style, tempo, camera work, and a set of characters for us to deal with, to shape, to build, to hide, and eventually to paint a portrait of. We'll never work on the same raw footage again once the job is over. And the unique concoction of visual ingredients that that particular job threw up won't materialize again, ever. But despite this, we humans are great at detecting patterns, similarities, and paradigms that allow us to make sense out of this chaos. The Swiss psychoanalyst Carl Jung created his famous archetypes, which were mythic characters within the collective unconscious. He identified 12 primary types that represent the range of basic human motivation. In the 1960s, the Canadian psychiatrist Eric Bernay categorized dozens of patterns of behavior within human relationships in his famous book, The Games People Play. And many of the screenwriting gurus of the last quarter century have reduced down the structures of most films to a handful of different narrative templates in order to teach people how to write in a language that audiences love and understand. These are all very useful examples of creating order out of chaos. They're not meant to be a mechanical checklist of everything that creates films, behavior, or human motivation. More like a loose guide and pattern recognition system that allows us to identify and replicate in any given field. This is largely, how I approach editing. That coquettish turn of the head and roll of the eyes from a character at the end of a scene I'm cutting creates a specific emotion in me and therefore in my audience. I've seen and crafted quite a few coquettish turns of the head and rolling of the eyes before from other characters that I've cut in other films that I've made. But this one's different. They're all different. It's probably in a different position in the scene, has a different meaning or emotional result. And of course, it's a completely different person who's doing it. We can extrapolate any kind of human behavior, screenwriting technique, or filmmaking structure out of this simple example. But you see the point that I'm making. We have similarities across many elements that make up a scene or sequence, and we use this categorization to break down and comprehend complexity in whatever form it takes. This point always reminds me of the great Mark Twain's quote on history. History doesn't repeat itself, but it often rhymes. I love that. The enormous amount of unique factors that go into anything from a historical event to a drama script can bring up echoes of others while at the same time still being unique. Again, pattern recognition. It was this factor that so often intrigued me while I was teaching myself the art of editing. What are the patterns of editing unique footage into language the audience can understand, into a structure the audience can understand? Out of the chaos of raw footage, what is the order? What is the grammar? What are the rules? I was continuously asking myself. Like most of the other editors of my generation, we struggled when learning the rules of this powerful art form because there simply wasn't anyone there to teach us and explain everything from the basic baby steps all the way to complex theories. The apprentice system that had survived for decades before the advent of nonlinear was dead by the mid-90s, and the new freelance editing economy had taken the financial incentive away from broadcasters, production companies, and post houses to train the freelancers who work for them. Why should they, if that editor might take this expensive training and then leave the company to work for a competitor? Then there was film school and media universities, a large percentage of which lag a good decade or so behind the industry in terms of knowledge. It seemed every time I managed to corner an editor to garner some advice, they'd always say the same thing to me and to all of my friends. Why would you want to go and get yourself into a huge amount of debt that would take 10 plus years to pay off, be taught filmmaking by people who weren't actually filmmakers, and then come out of it with a degree that the industry largely doesn't recognize? And then many of us went through door number three, buying DVDs and watching all of the extras that had editors talking about the craft. And this was extremely limited. By and large, most of them talked in very macro terms about editing. And while beautiful to hear, I remember being really frustrated by the whole process because all of this knowledge was only really applicable if you were cutting a major feature film, not where I was at. I wanted to know the baby steps. I wanted someone to talk to me while presuming I knew absolutely nothing about this art form. Why did these two shots cut together well and these two didn't? If I cut to the next shot, should I do it before or after the camera move stops? What are the rules when cutting these things? There were no books, no documentaries, no training manuals, no dedicated courses that weren't all about software. Nothing. And even though it was frustrating, it was fascinating at the same time. I'd stay late in post houses and sit and watch other people's edits hundreds of times over. I'd piece together the logic by watching every single cut and match framing both the outgoing and incoming shot and seeing what was around that point in the raw footage. Why did the editor cut on that exact frame and not in five frames before or after? Over several months, it quickly became apparent that our timeline has an invisible layer of rules and regulations underneath its beautifully designed surface. This is a grammar that no editing software manufacturer can penetrate, no matter how hard they try. This grammar is as important as commas, semicolons, and full stops in the written word, and is as old as our art form itself. Yes, you can break the rules, but just as Picasso once said, Only once you've learnt the rules can you break them. And yes, the rules evolve over time. You know, analysing how a movie was edited 50 years ago and seeing how it's edited now are two very different visual experiences. Go and watch Alfred Hitchcock's Rope. There's about 25 cuts in the whole film versus a John Woo movie from the 90s. But that evolution is constructed out of the current grammar it's in. We've never really been in a position where someone has thrown every rule out and literally started again, because this is a mass consumption art form. And so when thinking about this hidden grammar secretly embedded within our timeline, I started to think about the very nature of the timeline itself and how it was used by us editors. And here's the thing I realized. Most of the editing in our sequences is not done on the timeline. It's done beforehand in our mind, in that visualization area between our ears. The timeline is just a two-dimensional graphical representation of what's in our mind, with vertical tracks to indicate different content elements and a playhead that moves through the horizontal plane at a designated amount of frames per second, dependent on where you were in the world. And I love looking at this wonderful invention as a kind of horizontal and vertical grid. There seem to be two different types of logic embedded in each direction, especially in the genres I was cutting, mostly non-scripted, you know, entertainment shows, reality shows, documentary, news cutting, promo sequences, etc., etc. Now, on the horizontal plane, there seemed to be a whole bunch of visual grammar that I'd need to concern myself with. Firstly, the logic in the shot size changes. Wide shots to medium shots to close-ups to pans to tilts to zooms. Whoa, you know, there's a ton of things to consider there. But through constant analysis, a pattern started to emerge. Mostly, though not always, as the sequence progressed, the shot size would change as the cut happened. Wide shots went to medium shots, which went to close-ups, which went back to medium shots, etc., etc. There didn't seem to be a kind of rigid orthodoxy in the pattern. It was more about the grammar of moving to a different frame size when cutting to avoid a similarity in the frame size across the edit. Very interesting, I remember thinking. Drama seemed different. You know, the angle chosen had a lot more pre-thought out intention in it. And of course, you had the repeated action and performance retakes at different frame sizes to provide coverage for the editor. That was a different beast with different but by no means less complex rules. In non-scripted, the camera work was less thought out and shot a lot more rapidly and often under available light or limited constructed lighting. This meant that there was less options in non-scripted in terms of what shot size to cut to. Again, very interesting, I remember thinking. Of course, I did notice that on many occasions, an editor could cut from a close-up to another close-up or a medium shot to another medium shot repeatedly, but these were usually only under a few specific conditions. Firstly, it was a montage sequence, or secondly, the content that played out in the shot was very different from the same-sized previous shot or the shot it was going into. Aside from these and a few more visual anomalies, the idea of a shot size variation across time started to build up inside my consciousness. I remember writing notes about it to myself, clarifying and repeating it in my mind. Always show something new and in a different shot size as you cut a sequence. There's always exceptions, Paddy, but this is a good basic rule. The second major piece of visual grammar on the horizontal plane of my timeline seemed to be the camera movement and zooming. You know, it was difficult enough getting the logic right of the shot sizes as I blocked out the sequence of events, but add into the mix the camera movement and any zooming, and it got very complicated very quickly. But like most problems we encounter, they seem to melt under the consistent gaze of attention if you stare at it long enough. I was told from a very young age that persistence is one of the best traits a person can have by some very persistent people in my life. I looked at all of these amazing editors' work and tried to see the logic of how and when all of this movement within the frame or within the camera work played out in an edited sequence. And gradually, another pattern emerged. Largely, the slower the intended feel of a sequence or scene was, the more the editor let the camera movement and zooms finish before they cut to the next shot. They'd let things finish if the emotional tonality of the scene was relaxed, but they'd make the empty space around that movement shorter the faster the sequence was supposed to feel. It seemed to me that really fast sequences would often not let the camera movement finish at all before the cut. And that was how a lot of these editors were manipulating pace and timing within a scene. There was, of course, the speed of the actual camera movement or zoom to consider as well. It could be a long, slow pan that lasted 20 seconds and moved very, very slowly. You know, that was okay to cut out before the movement had ended, as the speed wasn't jarring for the viewer and didn't give an uninterrupted feeling if it was cut before the movement came to a close. And of course, there's a big difference between one of those long and slow zoom in or zoom out in one of those 70s westerns and a 12-frame long crash zoom in a reality TV montage. Much of this movement theory then seemed to fall into the pacing and tonality design across the horizontal plane of the timeline. It was silent. There was no way to see it on the timeline without playing it. But here's the phenomenal thing I saw in all of this work. It was all designed. I mean, every single cut was intentional. Not one frame was out of place because they designed the goal beforehand. The accumulative effect of all of this visual grammar was all pre-thought out in the editor's mind, and it literally blew me away in all of its intelligent complexity. There was an invisible language here embedded on the timeline, and I was hooked. I also started defining the sequential nature of what was being shown. Within any scene, no matter what the genre, there seemed to be these separated chains of action that were going on that were spread out over any number of shots. I started to watch and bunch them into mini sequential sequences in my mind. You know, a camera operator would break down action into a chain of connected shots to cover what was going on. This was very different from the singular shot of a building to establish the location of a scene. And this chain could be as little as a few shots, like a wide shot followed by a close-up of someone getting into a car, or a huge multi-shot sequence of a complicated piece of action happening over time. Say, for example, the B-roll of a meal being cooked on a cookery show. There could also be just one of these mini sequentially locked mini sequences in a scene, or several, dependent on how many different sets of action or camera positions there were in any given scene. My urge to break things down and classify them so as to understand them and be able to build them myself was often quite overwhelming. With more investigation, I discovered a whole bunch of other logic on the horizontal plane of the timeline. Continuity was a big one. The fluidity of action across the cut was another. And of course, the geographical positioning of the characters and how that changed over time. Broken down individually, they were interesting, but put together, they seemed to provide a set of logic that each cut had to pass through in order to make it watchable for the audience. You know, like anything in editing, there are no absolute rules. There's no encyclopedia of cutting techniques or list of rules that must be adhered to or the editing police will come after you. It's more based around a process of memorization of thousands of sequences that every editor goes through by themselves, but never articulates out loud. They simply don't need to as part of their job. And it's this lack of universally articulated laws in our art form that creates that age-old cliche you hear sometimes. You just feel the cut. You know it's right in your gut. Probably the most unhelpful thing I ever heard in my early editing years, and still hear today. The vertical plane seemed different. That was more about the interplay between the different elements that were stacked at that precise moment in time. This was just as intriguing, but in a different way. There were lots of different types, styles, and meanings on this vertical plane, and I identified a whole bunch. But the one I saw more than any other was what I decided to call "tell me, then show me." So what does this mean? Well, it looked like a very large percentage of scenes seemed to revolve around this variation of the following. A character would talk about something, and then we'd see B-roll shots or observational shots based on what they were talking about. They were connected. The logic was locked, not horizontally, but vertically, between these two elements, dialogue and image. Of course, it wasn't always like this, but just to reiterate, there's no absolute rules in editing. I was just trying to create pattern recognition to make sense out of this chaos of raw footage. There were anomalies, outliers, things that definitely worked outside of these patterns. There always is. I also noticed a kind of temporal delay that the editors would play with to vary the structure within Tell Me in Sync, Then Show Me in Picture scenes. Sometimes they delay it a little bit. You know, the dialogue sync would happen from a character, and it would be a second or two before you saw the corresponding shot. Or sometimes the shot would be slightly before, and then the dialogue sync from the character would come in. It was fascinating. The slightest adjustment of the positioning of each of these elements and the related connectivity on the vertical plane was amazing to watch. I spent hundreds of hours just messing around with that slight positioning in sequences that I was cutting, trying it out, seeing what the journalistic or emotional effect was if I nudged one element a little bit this way down the timeline or a little bit that way. And I am by no means unique. You know, we all do this, as editing has largely been a self-taught art form up until now. The thousands of hours of edit time that every editing artist goes through in order to find their golden key through the labyrinth of visual grammar creates the very foundations of how each of them sees this two-dimensional grid we call a timeline. No one really talks about it. But you can learn an enormous amount about editing by just watching a professional editor edit. You don't even need to talk or ask questions. Just sit and watch them work the timeline. Watch them cut things up, move things around. Watch, adjust, rewatch, and then finish. You can see them hit dead ends and how they react and how they fix. You can see how they overcome problems in the footage or structure by the addition or subtraction of certain elements. You know, on the rare occasions it's been possible for me to watch another editor, I've always done it, and it always intrigues me because every single editing artist is completely different. We all have a unique vision of what our timelines are going to look like with the footage given to us. But despite all of this, there is one thread that weaves its way through every pro editor, and that is the hidden logic of visual grammar. This is the secret language embedded in all of our films, no matter what the genre, that allows us to communicate with our audience. It's like discovering another continent. Go and check it out and see what you find. I hope you enjoyed this week's creative discussion, dear friends. Reach out to us on social and let us know your thoughts, your history, your ideas on visual grammar. Have you searched far and wide for a course on how to edit and found nothing? Do you like the creative detail we go into on this podcast? Have you ever tried to learn editing and just been inundated with courses and degrees that teach the software but not the art? Well, you are not alone. At Inside the Edit, we are the first and only company to create an online course that takes you through every single stage of the creative editing process, from baby steps to high-end professional. Through hundreds of visual examples, creative concepts, and stylization techniques, you will learn the secrets of this amazing art form. The Inside the Edit course will transform you into a powerful creative editor. Go to insidetheedit.com and try it for free. Okay, it's time for this week's What Am I Watching? Now, on the last show, we had the beautifully cut Fog of War, the Oscar-winning documentary by Errol Morris. I hope you got a chance to watch it. So much to learn from that film. This week, we're changing it up completely in terms of genre, style, tonality, and to be honest with you, pretty much everything. The 2013 Italian movie, The Great Beauty, is an absolute masterpiece and earned writer-director Paolo Sorrentino the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film the following year. It tells the story of Jep, a 65-year-old socialite and writer who has spent decades seducing and navigating the vacuous party scene in Rome, Italy. When an unexpected event from his past shocks him out of his gratuitous existence, Jep reevaluates his life and his home city of Rome, seeing past the nightclubs, the parties, the intellectual conversations to reveal a great beauty underneath. The film is masterfully cut by Sorrentino's longtime collaborator, Cristiano Travaglioli, and he handles Sorrentino's exquisite sequences with breathtaking flair. Anyone not familiar with Sorrentino's work is really missing out. He's been at the forefront of the European cinema scene for the last 20 years or so, and I can't think of anyone who moves the camera in such an unconventional and yet beautiful way. I learned a huge amount about rhythm and tempo from Sorrentino's Fellini-esque style of shooting and Travaglioli's amazing cutting style. There's a real daring and braveness to his cutting that is so unique. It kind of breaks a lot of the conventional rules around tempo, which is exactly why it's worth watching. The pace and timing and energetic design in each sequence is as exquisite as it is flamboyant. The other great thing to study in this, like all of Sorrentino's movies, is his use of music. The score is amazing. Their use of music is, again, so unconventional, but also absolutely brilliant. It ranges from classical choral music to Euro house tracks to obscure electronica. More than once, I've used tracks or artists I've discovered in a Sorrentino film, in a documentary I'm cutting, and it's always been to great effect. It's about an opposite a cutting style and energy as last week's choice, but no less brilliant and definitely worth studying. Paolo Sorrentino's The Great Beauty, edited by Cristiano Travaglioli, is my choice for this week. Go and watch it. You will not be disappointed. Okay, let me tell you about our latest live event we've got coming up at Inside the Edit, dear friends. Now, what is one of the most powerful ways to amaze a filmmaking client? Well, there's some big skills out there that the pros use every day to impress directors and producers. But high on that list is your ability to perfectly score a scene or sequence. Here's the thing. Most editors find a track that has some similarities to the scene or sequence they're editing or sounds cool. They then cut the scene and then place the track underneath on the lower layers and move on without any other manipulation. For a high-end editor, this is like folding your best hand in a game of poker. The difference between a music track that has just been overlaid across a sequence and a music track that has been analysed, restructured, retimed to match specific points in the scene, to match specific shots and camera work for maximum emotional and stylizational effect is pretty much night and day. High-end clients can spot this a mile off. The power of a perfectly scored music scene is like pouring petrol on a fire. The emotional intensity, the scene's purpose, and overall tonality shoot up exponentially. But, like everything in the art of editing, there are many different factors and things to learn in order to harness this creative power. So if you want to learn this valuable part of our art form, and start seriously impressing your clients, then our next live bootcamp is where you need to be. Part 2 of our music editing series is on Saturday, February the 12th at 3 p.m. London time. It's 2 hours, costs just £49, and you have a whole month to watch the recording if you miss the live session. You can also buy part one on the site if you've missed last month's fundamentals webinar. Go to the bootcamp page over at insidetheedit.com to get your front row seat. It's going to be a fantastic session. Okay, it's time for this week's Ask Paddy. And for today's show, we got a great question from Rodrigo in Spain. Now, it's a little bit techie, and you know my thoughts on tech, but I actually think there's a big creative aspect to it. So let's dive straight in. Now, Rodrigo asks, do you usually create a new sequence, then mark the in and out around the content that you like, and then edit it onto the timeline? Or do you stick all of the raw footage on the timeline and directly cut out the rubbish? Great question. Like I said, sounds a bit techie, and we do have an aversion to anything techie on this podcast, but let's look at it through the lens of creativity. First, let's rephrase the question to help us visualize it. It's about the difference between pulling good content out of the raw footage and placing it down onto the timeline one by one versus putting it all down onto the timeline and pulling out bad content and thus leaving or revealing only the good content. It's kind of like building a wall versus making a sculpture. You select each brick one by one from a pile of bricks and then place it onto the wall versus with a sculpture, you start off with a huge slab of marble or block of clay or whatever you're making it with, and you gradually get rid of small pieces of the marble or clay by chiseling away at it and slowly revealing the structure. So for me, this kind of procedural way to look at workflow when assembling is based on a number of different factors. Let's lay them down. What genre am I working in? If I'm working in an actuality type project, say a reality TV scene or an observational documentary or an entertainment show, maybe a news report, the shooting style is usually quite high speed and the duration of the raw footage is usually quite long. The object of the assembly is to mine through the content, which moves very fast, lots of camera movement, geographical repositioning of characters, zooms, etc., etc., and strip out the superfluous elements as quickly as possible. Now, this would be a lot harder if we were doing it shot by shot or camera move by camera move or dialogue line by dialogue line. This genre lends itself to subtractive, timeline-based assembly editing because of the style, speed, and duration. You know, duration and shooting style drive choices around procedural workflow, in my experience. However, if we're working in a more classical genre like documentary or drama, where the camera movement, dialogue, interviews, etc., is a little more intentional and pre-thought out, I would probably go the other way. I would be more precise around the selection. But I probably wouldn't use a marking in and marking out and then edit down to the timeline strategy. I'd probably use subclips. Instead of taking that marked in and out clip and editing it onto the timeline, I'd subclip it back into the bin and label it, thus building a digital filing cabinet of clearly labeled and easily accessible clips that I can use throughout the course of my edit. As usual, you know what I'm going to say now, there are no hard and fast rules, and some editors prefer doing it in a certain way and not others. But knowing that, all that really matters in a film is a couple of different things. Is it cut in the best way possible for the maximum dramatic effect? And did we meet the deadline? Whichever path you choose to climb up the mountain is of little interest to most directors and producers. They just want a great film done on time. You know, I always think that it's not a question of right or wrong. It's more of a question of what works best in any given scenario. The added aspect is also personal history. You know, if you taught yourself your favorite editing software, or someone you worked with taught you, or a film lecturer taught you, or a YouTuber taught you, whomever, whatever procedural way they taught you and you learnt, you'll have a hard time changing that behavior because it's so hardwired. So, to summarize the answer to your question, Rodrigo, Analyze the type of footage you have, the duration of the footage you have, and look at your deadline. Sometimes the turnaround on this particular job we're cutting is so short that we just don't have time for such a detailed breakdown of the footage, and we just need to get it done and get it out to the client. Thanks for the question, my friend, and I hope this helps you out. That is a wrap for episode 7 of season 3 of Once Upon a Timeline, the Creative Editing Podcast. No show would be complete without a massive shout out to our longtime friends and partners over at Universal Production Music. You guys rock. If you're sourcing music right now for your projects, go and check out their site. They have over 500,000 tracks in every conceivable genre, tone, tempo, and mood. We've never used any other music library at Inside the Edit. We're a very small company here at Inside the Edit, just a few passionate filmmakers trying to spread the word about this beautiful art form of ours. Helping us grow our creative community is really appreciated, so please don't forget to tag us on social and share it with your filmmaking friends. However, if you have 30 seconds to spare, a rate and review on Apple Podcasts is also really, really appreciated. Thank you so much for being part of the Inside the Edit community. I wish you a productive and creative week on your timeline, dear friends, and I'll see you very soon on another episode of Once Upon a Timeline. Stay cool, stay safe, and of course, stay cutting.